Hello, I'm Carol Waddis and this is Theatre Voice. Michael Boyd took over running of the Royal Shakespeare Company at a time when its future looked decidedly shaky. Morale was low, its artistic reputation had taken a battering, and its finances were in need of repair. That was in 2003. Since then, Michael has transformed the company's fortunes. Together with Executive Director Vicky Haywood, they are now on the brink of a landmark moment in the RSC's history. A new season about to open at the Roundhouse, and before that comes the long-awaited reopening of the Royal Shakespeare and Swan Theatres in Stratford after a £112.8 million four-year redevelopment. Raising the money is only half of it. Opening on time and on budget is even more remarkable. Michael, welcome to Theatre Voice. You got there just in time. Do you think you'd ever have been able to pull this project off if you were starting now?
Well, of course, the National are embarking on a pretty ambitious, I think it's £50 million programme,
yes.
Right now, bang in the middle of the recession. I think they've got a great head of steam on, and I think they might pull it off. I think the scale of what we're doing would be very difficult right now. Of course, there are still individuals of high net worth who have done quite well out of the recession, and they might well be inclined to help us at this stage. But I'm not sure that public bodies, and they've played a massive part in this, the Arts Council,
yes,
lottery scheme, and also Advantage West Midlands, which has been abolished now by the Conservative government. And I think the short answer is no. We wouldn't have a ghost there.
Your thought, when you came into the company, was the idea of transforming the theatres, was it already, as it were, a seed in your mind? So would you have been having that thought, do you think, if it was now?
When I took over the company, I was appointed in 2002, the RSC had already been working for 7 years on the idea of transforming the Royal Shakespeare Theatre when it first opened, and when Peter Hall formed the Royal Shakespeare Company in 1961, there was an intention to improve it, to change it, from Peter Hall's point of view, to radically change it.
Mm.
So it wasn't a new idea. It was very clear for a very long time that something needed to be done about an auditorium that had basically been designed as a cinema and was inappropriate for theatrical performance, despite some fantastic performances.
Absolutely.
In that space.
Absolutely.
You can win against the odds.
Yes.
But why not stack the odds more in your favour?
Yes.
The previous years had fallen on stony ground, I think, I would say, ultimately, because it was in pursuit of a two-headed monster. A theatre that could be two things at once, a proscenium theatre and a thrust theatre, which made it ginormous. Because to accommodate the sight lines of both arrangements, you have to have a vast auditorium, bigger even than the old Royal Shakespeare Theatre, which would be unfriendly, cold, and with no personality, because it was neither fish nor fowl.
Mm.
And I suppose my main decision was to bite the bullet and say, we're going in one direction,
right,
and we're going to achieve that.
Right. So you've gone for three-sided, haven't you?
You've gone
for thrust.
We've gone for a shape that Shakespeare would recognise, and I think we've gone for the shape that is my bet for the next 50 years of the RSC, i.e. that our art form is increasingly going to be appreciated for its ability to bring together people uniquely in community around the great ideas, the great emotions, the great fears, the great hopes that we share as human beings.
Mm.
And I think film and television and interactive media will do all sorts of wonderful things. My bet is that what theatre will do is that it will make the exploration of what it's like to be a human being a communal experience, and people value that more and more as time goes on.
And you think that this particular shape that you decided on is going to be the best way to deliver that kind of feeling?
I think you can also do it with the sort of lovely site-specific work that people like Shunt and Punch Drunk have been getting so good at recently. But that's on a tiny scale. And all too often, it's the people in the know, the coterie, the cliques, the elite, that get to go to see these lovely immersive performances.
Yes. Yes.
If theatre is going to achieve that quality, that gift of community, on a scale that allows it to take part in the culture, in mainstream culture, it's going to have to happen in large auditoria. And this is the auditorium in which to do that.
Can I just put to you what one or two critics have already, I think, probably thrown at you? I don't think this is a new question for you. But if you've got the RST with that shape, and you've also got the Swan Theatre in a similar shape, is that going to limit the kind of designs that designers in the future might want to come up with? In other words, would it have been, is there going to be a possibility for some kind of flexibility? I don't know, having audiences behind or around, you know, whatever, or flying things in.
Well, there are lots of answers to that question.
Yep.
Lots of questions.
Good.
In that question.
Yes.
First of all, even in the temporary prototype of the courtyard, I don't think we have hampered the imagination or the achievement of designers. We've seen on very restricted budgets and facilities in the courtyard, we've seen amazing, lovely visual ideas. Of course, the new theatre has a full-length fly tower and a full-depth basement. You can bring the whole of the Forest of Arden either down from above or up from below, or a combination of the two. There's a difference, which is designers, like film designers increasingly perhaps, and I have to think in three dimensions rather than two. Mm. I think that's a good thing.
Mm.
In terms of the duplication of shape in the Swan and the RST, there are again different answers to that. One is, the Swan is probably the most popular and most loved theatre in the whole of the UK.
Yes.
Let's not.
I love it. Yes.
So I'm not worried.
Yes.
About people associating the new Royal Shakespeare Theatre with the Swan, although it's got a totally different character. If it makes more possible a success from the Swan to transfer immediately into the RST, and for bold experiments, for new repertoire to more easily find their way into the aorta of our bloodstream on our main stage, that's fantastic. If, as is already happening, I have a queue of artists, actors, directors, designers round the block, desperate to work on our main space, that is good news to me, and it's certainly a very different situation from that which I faced when we had the old Royal Shakespeare Theatre, a proscenium theatre, where we had wonderful facilities in one room and we had lovely comfy seats in another room next to it.
Yes.
And people peered at each other through a big hole.
Yes.
I don't think that is going to be acceptable increasingly for our art form.
What are some of the joys from your point of view of this new building? You have spoken with enormous, I think, pleasure and excitement at the building that you're about to open the front door on.
The first one, there's so many. There's so many. The first and most important.
Give us a flavour.
Is,
for your,
we have halved the distance of the worst seat in the house, or rather the furthest seat in the house.
Yes.
From the stage. You are twice as close.
So it's going to be twice as intimate in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
So it is, I can't think of another auditorium in the world that marries the epic and the intimate as much as we do here. The other thing about the auditorium that I completely adore is the joyful sense of sharing in the same space, breathing the same air through real time.
Mm.
That the auditorium gives you.
In which you feel the older auditorium couldn't do in the same kind of way.
No, you're all looking. Mm. Nobody's looking at each other. The audience are all looking at this picture. They might occasionally share a sweetie with their neighbour, But there's no sense of being together at all. Now, there's an advantage to that if you're not doing very well as a theatre company, because nobody notices the empty seats in an auditorium, because you're all looking at the stage. But we're lucky in that, well, and we've earned it, I suppose, we don't have very many empty seats. So we can... And we're pursuing this optimistically also, thinking that in the future we're going to carry on being good, we're going to carry on having a lot of demand for our experience, and I hope, you know, that will build confidence in the audience as well to come and share. I loved it when in the grain store I fed some of the audience on stage, and that sense of welcome that I think we've improved massively in the courtyard in an informal way. There's much more of a sense of being welcomed into the building, and I suppose that would be my next favourite thing about the new RST, is that both architecturally, in terms of glowing in the dark at night or during the day, having a sense of all its doors being open, you are welcomed in by what Bennett's associates, the architects, have done, and the spaces, once you're in there, are... Again, they're intriguing, they're welcoming. I was worried at one stage, at the very beginning of the design process, we were massively increasing the available public space. Mm. Would that make them impressive but rather intimidating? Mm. It's a very famous national, international arts organisation. Yeah. We're getting people through the doors, but it's no good if when they come through the doors they're going, oh... in a sort of hushed sort of... but no, they're really interesting, quirky spaces that invite you to go further into the building. So I think that's a great success. And just putting those two joys together, the theatre itself and the spaces for the public and to make them feel welcome, in the restaurant, on the very, very top of the building, which used to be where... the school kids used to go in the cheap seats.
Yes.
With a pokey little corridor and a pokey little bar and a pokey little balcony. Now is a glorious rooftop restaurant with the whole of that floor available to it, because there are no audience up there. But on a preserved wall from the old building, in the middle of the restaurant, there are now three seats in a row from the old auditorium, exactly where they were in the old days.
Yes.
And people can enjoy their fish and chips, look up and look across at the back wall of the auditorium and realise just how far away you were expected to sit from the stage. So there's a lovely sort of joke in the architecture there that I'm very fond of.
It's interesting, there's the panoply of the events that are surrounding the opening, and it's, I'm once going to ask you a question about, you've got quite a long lead-in, actually, haven't you? So we'll talk about that in a moment. But I was quite interested to see that some of the activities, quite a few of them, have got a really local emphasis, which made me feel that there's quite a concentration on the theatre, not just as an international, as a theatre of international repute, but it is a theatre in the heart of Warwickshire. It is a local theatre as well. You seem to have taken quite a lot of trouble in the opening events anyway to make sure that Warwickshire people, Stratford people, feel this is a theatre for them. And I was up at Leicester last week at the Curb, which I've never seen before. You know, completely, you've probably seen it, haven't you? Mm. Completely glass. Mm. And very welcoming, I think, in many senses. So... has that been one of your ideas to say to Warwickshire people, this is your theatre, as well as it being an international theatre?
My first job was a trainee directorship at the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry.
Was it?
And as a child of not just the Belgrade, but the Crucible in Sheffield.
Yes.
And as someone who founded a theatre in the East End of Glasgow, the Tron Theatre.
The Tron,
It's just not surprising that I'm interested in a relationship with our immediate surrounds, our region. And from the word go, I've been very comfortable with us being a regional theatre company, as well as a national and an international company. To be honest, Shakespeare was a very regional author. as well as being the best author of all time. You come from specifics, yes. and that's how you get to the universal. And I think to abstract yourself from where you live is to put yourself in danger of losing touch with yourself. And I'm proud that one aspect of my artistic directorship at the RSC has been a greatly enhanced degree of harmony with people around us, with the local people.
Yes. Well, you've done quite a lot with the University of Warwick, haven't you?
Yes. Well, I mean, that's certainly... We have collaborated with the University of Warwick a great deal, and right now they are working our actors together with our education team. Some of our actors, about a third of our actors every year, take a qualification in the teaching of Shakespeare, which means that they are then fantastically powerful allies to the education department in our whole outreach program towards kids, and our work has deservedly gained quite a lot of recognition in that area throughout the country and indeed internationally. And we're now working with the University of Warwick on an idea for an even more ambitious international program of training people in the teaching of Shakespeare.
I mean, that does seem, if I think about what you've achieved since you took over, Michael, not only just in raising, again, the profile and the respect that we all have for the RSC, but it has been your terrific concern about making sure that the young generation, that Shakespeare is not lost, as it were, to the young generation, the educational outreach, I mean, Stand Up for Shakespeare and all the rest. It's obviously, apart from the architectural relationship within the theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, it's also the relationship between Shakespeare and today's generation. Am I right?
Well, look, these things can be really simple. Again, going back to my time as a trainee at the Belgrave.
Yeah.
Probably, artistically, the two most vivid areas of the Belgrave when I was there as a trainee were the Theatre and Education Company, fantastically talented group of people, including Rob Bettinson, the director of the Buddy the Musical, Linda Bassett, Phil Whitchurch, who was playing the father in Billy Elliot for years, and a really great team doing fantastic work both with kids and with adults. And the other area that was tremendous was the youth theatre at the Belgrade was again doing tremendous work. Mm-hmm. So I'm not just giving a priority to our work with young people from a socially motivated view, mm-hmm. or from the point of view of preserving tomorrow's audience for Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. It's because I'm looking to that area to provide fresh stimulus for our work as a theatre company. I think Theatre Go Round in the very early days
yes.
played some of that role for the RSC and was the genesis of, for instance, the other plays. I think when you're working from first principles with young people, as you have to, you tend to come up with fresh ideas which eventually find their way onto the main stage and enhance your reputation and your work.
Mm, definitely. You and I, the last time I saw you by chance was in the East End at the Frantic Assembly in National Theatre of Scotland's beautiful Burnout. And I was thinking then what an exciting atmosphere had been generated. What did you think of that evening?
I'm a huge fan of the National Theatre of Scotland.
Me too.
And I think they're an inspiring example to Nick Heitner and me, you know, in some ways,
yes.
about how to run a national theatre.
Yes.
They were that particular project was unfortunate. It was just a bit of perchancity in the timing. It opened right at the same time as another highly choreographed show about boxing called Sucker Punch at the Royal Court, and I'm not sure it was quite on song as Sucker Punch, but being there that night with you, in that venue,
yes.
An unorthodox venue,
yes.
In the East End of London, with a great idea for a very successful discount scheme for people in the postcode. I met people from the area who really had been communicated with that because they lived locally, they were going to get cheap seats.
Yes.
And it worked, and it got them in.
Yes.
And with Frantic Assembly, it's always going to be exciting and stimulating.
Yes.
And kind of liberating in a way, watching it. And the actors were fantastic. And the audience was utterly included in the event, which was great. It was a great occasion. It was lovely.
Can you see yourself working with Frantic Assembly, or have you?
I've done a great deal of work with another seminal individual in terms of movement in theatre, Liz Rankin. I've worked with over the years a great deal.
Yes.
And she's had a great influence on my work. And I do not, and never have, allowed the sort of civil war in this country between text-based theatre and movement-based theatre. I've never allowed that into my heart. I don't see them as enemies, I'm afraid. I think the theatre that really thrills me is brilliantly authored with profoundly challenging and beautiful texts, and acknowledges that the actors that perform them have bodies as well, and they are operating in space.
Yes. I saw the most beautiful piece, actually, The Unicorn. Do you remember Noel Gray,
yeah.
who died recently?
Yeah.
Just did a 45-minute piece called The Tin Soldier, one solo, two musicians, and it was 45 minutes of wonderful physical delivery of words and music.
Mm.
And it can be very, very simple, can't it? Tell me a little bit about how you've planned the opening of the theatre, because it actually opens very shortly, and then you go through a certain series of, as it were, small waves before you reach, is it next April, when there's going to be another big, as it were, official launch. Tell me some of the thinking behind that.
The thinking's dominated by the wisdom that we gathered furiously at the start of this process from other people who'd gone through capital programmes, and of course I've been fantastically lucky in this process, because the administrative side of the RSC is headed up by Vicky Hayward, who's gone through an awful lot of scary moments already with the Royal Court redevelopment programme, and indeed their opening night was at the Old Vic, which is a scar that still goes pink now and again in cold weather for Vicky.
Yes.
So she learned her lessons there, and is tremendously experienced. Peter Wilson, the project director, was project director for the enormously successful Tate Modern conversion.
Yes.
And Simon Harper, his deputy, lived through the whole of the refurbishment of the English National Opera buildings at the Coliseum.
So very, very experienced.
I don't think you could have got a much better team anyway.
No.
And, yes, lesson one, give yourself time. Open slowly. So, there will be, at every stage you find out new things. So the moment you are given the keys and it's yours again, you find out things that you couldn't possibly have known.
Mm.
And it's true, it's happening now.
Yes.
But we have programmed it in such a way that we have time to address issues before we open to the public. Then you find out all sorts of other new things.
Absolutely.
Maybe
yeah.
our toilets won't all flush at the same time, and you will have to deal with that, but we've given ourselves time. Meanwhile, gradually slowly putting our feet on our stages with little one-person shows, concerts, and minimal risk pieces, building up to small shows like something very exciting. Peter Brook is bringing his dramatization of the sonnets, which is also emotionally wonderful to bring Peter Brook, one of the founding directors, back for the first time since the 80s, I think.
Yes, that would be fantastic.
But also, with something that's come out of research and development and experiment now, Camilo Sullivan has been working with us on a new dramatization of The Rape of Lucrece, a commercially successful avant-garde singer coming to bear on one of Shakespeare's great poems. That's going to be brilliant. Then, so that's the first stage. The next stage is we do proper big Shakespeare productions, but we do revivals. So Romeo and Juliet and King Lear, which we've already played in our repertoire, are coming back to properly give the new auditorium a real workout. I'm very gently saying hello again to the Swan with a sort of unplugged small-scale version of Antony and Cleopatra again from the repertoire. That's the second stage. We will learn all sorts of things from that, and hopefully by the time the new season, starting with my production of Macbeth with Jonathan Slinger, by the time we're in production week, a lot of the glitches will already have been ironed out. And so the Hullabaloo opening will be one that we're well prepared for.
And you felt that it was safer to do that, as it were, with a revival rather than as it do a great kind of all guns blazing, this is a new production, this is a new theatre. Would
the received wisdom from the English National Opera, from the Royal Court, from every major capital arts programme has been open with a revival. And also my experience as an audience member at lovely opening nights around the place has been... oh dear, they've been concentrating on the building, haven't they? And they haven't really been concentrating on this show. And it shows. You know, it's very rare that you get a lovely work of art and open a lovely new building at the same time.
Yes.
So we've got lovely works of art in Romeo and Juliet and King Lear, and we know they're lovely works of art.
Yes.
And we don't mind if the building is what gets the attention, because they're solid.
And people will want to come and see the building. There must be enormous interest, isn't there? There's huge interest in it. What are you doing? Have you got any indication at this stage of what the cuts are going to, how they're going to affect you?
Well, not really, in a way, because, of course, everyone's now got their settlement for for next year, just so that you can keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Yes.
But everybody has got to incredibly quickly reapply for all their funding by the end of January, which is extraordinary. And we will the plan is that we find out by the end of March what our funding for the next 3, 4, 5, or 6 years is.
Does that worry you? A big new building, a big new, you know, venture?
Of course it worries.
Kind of cutting back on staff,
of
cutting back on the number of productions.
Yeah. I mean, in the meantime, Vicky and I and the whole management team are just playing it carefully, not making new appointments unless they're absolutely necessary, not replacing people who are leaving for whatever reason. We're on a pay freeze, all of us. We're battening down the hatches.
Yes.
Even as we sail out into this wonderful new ocean.
It's such a paradox, isn't it?
It is. But I'm very happy for us to be this month and in the coming months a kind of candle in the dark. While obviously generally things are very, very difficult.
But the arts too, I mean, it's a general misconception, isn't it? The arts organisations, I know, and you know, actually lean machines, aren't they, when it comes to actually running themselves. There are very few, particularly theatre companies these days, in the last 10, 20 years, who've actually gone over the odds.
Well, just obviously, I mean, we're quite a large organisation, so we're a definite target for scrutiny. And I think almost every month I do that horrible thing of looking around the organisation and thinking, is there anybody twiddling their thumbs? Not with a view of sack them, but because we need help. You know, there might be somebody in a completely different discipline who would be really useful manning the pumps elsewhere, where yes. people are working fantastically hard and really do need some relief. They need a day off or something. Someone could man the phone for them or something like that. And really, I think in a way, the RSC is at its best when it's opening a theatre, opening a London season, opening a major new musical, and building an auditorium for a major New York residency, and planning an international Shakespeare festival. That's the sort of... It's mad.
It is completely mad.
But it is... It is
exhilarating as well, isn't it?
And it is when
brings out the best.
It really makes sense of a large national arts organisation with extraordinary talent.
Two final questions, because I know that you've got to move on. Are you going to, given the shape of things to come over the next couple of years, are you going to manage to keep new writing at the forefront? And are you going to manage to keep a small lab in, you know, going somehow?
Even in these cuts, we have... we have preserved the budget for us, quite a substantial budget for the development of new plays, but also new and experimental projects. And there are lots of really lovely things coming through the pipeline. Next year, we are doing, that's the other thing, of course, that we're doing. we've got this new Camilo Sullivan take on Rape of Lucrece. We're about to open a marvellous season at Hampstead of a new play by Rona Munro,
yes,
new play by Terrell McCraney,
yes,
and a new play devised with David Farr and Filter, with our long ensemble company at their ripest and readiest. And later in the year, we're also premiering new plays by David Edgar, by Helen Edmondson. It's a big year for new writing. It's our biggest year for years.
But will you still have a small hub that you can throw things around and... You know,
oh, eventually
a small venue.
The next thing is the other place.
So I was going to say to you that the very last question is: do you need to find a permanent? You're always asked when you're going to find a new permanent place in London. Is it still necessary? Can you be itinerant like the National Theatre of Scotland, the National Theatre of Wales, in a way?
We have made a success of it for the past 8 years. Being flexible, being able to box and cox and cut our cloth. But personally, I would say we absolutely need it, and I think that the solution to the long-term home for London lies in the auditorium that we're building for Park Avenue Armoury for our New York residency next year. That 900-seat auditorium, I bet you, will end up in London and will be our new London home.
And you heard it here first. Michael, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.